today with a formal land acknowledgement. Review this 5-day seminar, Mr. Pauling, over the levee under the plow, as a prolonged land acknowledgement, and also consider an attempt to land the plow. We move the word from words to action, in other words, we grapple with what it means to live and work on indigenous land. Land acknowledgements are necessary but insufficient gestures of accountability to indigenous peoples in place to see Pauling present. Kelsey Bowell, an AT writer and teacher from Alberta, invites us to, quote, start imagining a constellation of relationships that must be entered into beyond territorial and land acknowledgements. She encourages us to, quote, start learning our obligations, learning about our obligations as guests in this territory. So one of the very first obligations as guests is to know the names of your hosts and to listen closely to them. Moving beyond territorial acknowledgements, Bowell continues, means asking hard questions about what needs to be done once we're aware of indigenous presence. It requires that we remain uncomfortable, and it means making concrete, disruptive change. How can you be in good relationship with indigenous peoples, with non-human beings, with the land and water? No idea. Well, it's a good thing indigenous people are still here, because our legal orders address all of those questions. So why aren't you asking us? This seminar centers indigenous people's perspectives and places. We hope this will become clear over the next few days. However, as three white settlers now living in Boston and Chicago, we believe it is necessary to acknowledge the role of white supremacy in shaping this Anthropocene landscape, and also in authorizing us to welcome you here today and to facilitate this particular form of territorial inquiry. Anthropologist Heather Ann Swanson writes, quote, white middle-class American subjectivities are predicated on not noticing. They're predicated on structural blindness, on a refusal to acknowledge the issues we inherit. As organizers of the Anthropocene Field Station, we felt it was important to begin here, to start acknowledging the histories we inherit here. Indeed, we felt it was our responsibility, in part, to highlight the inherent coloniality of the Anthropocene. We want to suggest that for this region, the Anthropocene began here, right here. We take seriously our decision to begin here and now at Black Hawk Park on September 25th, 2019.
We begin this 5-day seminar in a place usually marked as an ending. Not far from where we sit, a massacre took place. On August 1st and 2nd, 1832, the U.S. Army and an Illinois militia fired on a group of starving, exhausted Native Americans, mostly Sauk and Meskwaki, but also Kickapoo, Ho-Chunk, and Potawatomi, like the others, as they tried to cross the Mississippi River to safety. Their leader, Black Hawk, had already tried to surrender several times during the so-called war that bears his name, and the massacre began despite the fact that he once again waved a flag of truce. When soldiers began firing, Black Hawk's band had little choice but to provide cover for those trying to cross the river. Soldiers on the bluffs streamed down to shoot at closer range, while a military riverboat fired on retreating families with cannons. Although some made it to safety, many of those who crossed the river were soon captured by U.S. ally Dakota. Militiamen gleefully mutilated the corpses. Sharpshooters deliberately targeted babies. When reproached for these actions, which were shocking and horrifying at the time, one volunteer soldier coldly replied, "Kill commits, and you will have no rights." That is officially called the Battle of Bad Axe. The carnage was so one-sided that it was started to be described as a massacre since the 1850s, but the name has never been changed. Of nearly 2,000 people who had joined Black Hawk in April to contest the terms of a fraudulent treaty and returned to their ancestral village at Sauconuck to farm, only 39 foot survivors were captured at the conclusion of the massacre. Many had died on the journey, and others no doubt managed to escape. Black Hawk surrendered to authorities a few days after the massacre and was imprisoned just down the river in Prairie du Chien, which was also where the treaties that ended up ceding all this territory were signed. The Black Hawk War inaugurated an era of massive change to physical, cultural, and political landscapes. A newsletter letter from the Dane County Historical Society sums it up. Without an Indian War threat, Wisconsin territory was created just 4 years later rapid settlement produced statehood in 1848. The genocidal war unleashed a new phase of regional settler colonization and justified an aggressive campaign of removal of the northern Indian nations, including the Ho-Chunk, Meskwaki, Iowa, and Kickapoo nations. Historian Jeffrey Osler argues, after the Bad Axe massacre, federal officials seized the moment to separate Indians from their lands. Whether they had supported Black Hawk, remained neutral, or assisted the U.S. government made no difference. Beginning in 1832, the Ho-Chunk suffered multiple removals from Wisconsin to Iowa, Minnesota, Dakota Territory, and Nebraska. Of course, some Ho-Chunk refused to be removed and remained in or returned to each of these places.
The Bad Axe massacre has a prehistory, a context. Zebulon Pike camped in what is now Black Hawk Park during his expedition to find the headwaters of the Mississippi River. Be of interest to those of you who are coming from Field Station 1 in the headwaters. A land cession treaty had been signed in St. Louis in 1804 by a Sauk delegation that did not expect to enter into land negotiations and lacked the authority to do so, leading many in the nation to regard the treaty as invalid and resist American attempts to enforce it. The fraudulent treaty and increasing squatter incursions into their territory prompted the Sauk, Meskwaki, Ho-Chunk, and Potawatomi to support the British during the War of 1812. Black Hawk himself was a veteran of that war and incorporated British insignias into his wardrobe for the rest of his life. With victory over the British in 1814, the U.S. assumed actual rather than nominal control over the so-called Northwest Territories, and settlers began arriving en masse. At the conclusion of that war, Sauk capital, where we'll end this seminar, was the largest city in what would soon become Illinois. Occupied mostly during the growing season when the tribe returned from its winter hunting grounds in what is now Iowa, Sauk's log houses were surrounded by vegetable and corn fields. The lead deposits of northwest Illinois and southwest Wisconsin were mined seasonally by Ho-Chunk, Sauk, and Meskwaki women. These well-stewarded resources were extremely attractive to settlers. And from the 1820s, both Sauk and Meskwaki leaders began to complain of finding white squatters living in their homes, stealing their corn, and mining the ore with people they had enslaved. In this historical context, we can understand Black Hawk Park and the nearby town of Victory, and the Black Hawk Trail, which will be following over the next 5 days, as, quote, environmental fantasies of our settler ancestors. For many indigenous peoples in North America, asserts Potawatomi scholar Kyle Powis White, quote, we are already living in what our ancestors would have understood as dystopian or post-apocalyptic times. In a cataclysmically short period, the capitalist-colonialist partnership has destroyed our relationships with thousands of species and ecosystems. Settler ancestors wanted today's world, argues White. They would have relished the possibility that some of their descendants could freely commit extractive violence on indigenous lands and then feel, with no doubts, that they are ethical people. And that's a sentiment, actually, that Black Hawk echoed or expressed in very similar terms in his autobiography regarding that 1804 treaty. So we must acknowledge this, too, and sit with the discomfort acknowledgement arouses. A few years ago, Sarah and I published a book about settler appropriations of Black Hawk's name and image across the landscape shaped by the conflict and its aftermath. George Thurman, a direct descendant of Black Hawk and then principal chief of the Sac and Fox Nation of Oklahoma, offered a short essay for the book to describe both his and his tribe's relationship to this person, Makatai Mishikyakyak, or Black Hawk. And these are a few of his words. To say that Black Hawk still has relevance to the Sac and Fox implies a hold to the past. We're all connected, part of those who came before, and holding on to what they taught us for those yet to come. However, our past is not a fixed point that grows farther away with each new generation. Instead, our past is like a bloodline, living, breathing, and growing as we grow. As a descendant, my perspective about Black Hawk is more personal. He is a very real part of what I bring to the Sac and Fox Nation as its chief and who I am as Sac and Fox. I have visited the places where he walked and could place my own footsteps where his had been. I stood on the banks of the Mississippi River at Bad Axe, where 179 years ago I would have been a target for the guns and cannon just for being Sauk. So many of our people died there. The massacre still echoes within us. It was a tragic ending. But I, a member of that same tribe, stood there at that place of ending and saw my people of today make offerings at the riverside. Black Hawk fought so his people could live, and there, where one might think it all ended for us, we stood, remembering our people in the way they left to us, and that is uniquely ours. Without a doubt, we gather here today because of the massacre that took place on August 1st and 2nd, 1832. But that is obviously not all that has happened here, and we must not let that singular event define this place. Following Dakota artist Mona Smith, we can understand Black Hawk Park as a wounded place. In this sense, the confluence of the Bad Axe and Mississippi Rivers is not unlike Bedote, the confluence of the Minnesota and Mississippi Rivers. Following Christine DeLuccia, we must challenge ourselves to understand, quote, how memories of devastation exist relationally alongside those of regeneration. If the Mississippi Valley can be understood in part by tracing indigenous removals and land cessions, it can also be understood in terms of refusals and returns, particularly among the Ho-Chunk and Meskwaki nations. The effects of removals are felt today and every day and shape what Nick Estes calls, quote, the indigenous political practice of return, restoration, and reclamation of belonging and place.
We begin this five-day seminar 41 hours after an equinox, 6 days into a student-led global climate strike, a few months after the water that covered this park for much of the spring and early summer receded. In the more wooded, driftless area where the seminar begins, the absence of glacial drift left hills and incised deep valleys. Ironically and tellingly, the driftless is coated with a layer several meters thick in many places of what scientists call post-settlement alluvium or legacy sediment, the result of 19th century Euro-American agricultural practices that initiated widespread erosion and washed upland sediment into the region's valleys. Throughout the region, the seminar explores colonization produced a massive redistribution of soil and sediment that reshaped the surface of the earth.
Last Thursday, the New York Times reported on a new article in the journal Science, that many of you may have read, that shows that the number of birds in the United States and Canada has fallen by 29% since 1970, which means there are 2.9 billion fewer birds taking wing now than there were 50 years ago. We're standing, of course, in the Mississippi Flyway, a vital migration corridor for more than 325 bird species, which pass by here twice a year en route from breeding grounds in Canada and the northern United States to wintering grounds along the Gulf of Mexico and in Central and South America. A few weeks earlier, the Times reported, this year's flooding across the Midwest and the South affected nearly 14 million people. Quote, the year through May 2019 was the wettest 12-month period on record in the United States, according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Edward Clark, director of the NOAA's National Water Center, said, quote, this is a year that will remain in our cultural memory, in our history. The year has continued to be very wet. 2019, which of course isn't even over yet, we have witnessed and have been unevenly impacted by historic flooding along the Mississippi and Missouri rivers and many of their tributaries, including ones we'll pass by over the next 5 days. The Kickapoo River, for example, was flooded just last Sunday. 40 miles south of here at Wyalusing State Park, you'll find a monument dedicated to the last Wisconsin passenger pigeon, which was shot dead in September 1899. In his 1946 dedication speech on a monument to the pigeon, Aldo Leopold reflected, quote, we have erected a monument to commemorate the funeral of the species. It symbolizes our sorrow. We grieve because no living man will see again the onrushing phalanx of victorious birds sweeping a path for spring across the March skies, chasing the defeated winter from all the woods and prairies of Wisconsin. This is a monument to the future. Like the monument to the vanishing Oaktuckle Glacier in Iceland, which was unveiled in July to much fanfare, the pigeon monument invokes the universal we. Quote, this monument is to acknowledge that we know what is happening and what needs to be done. Only you know if we did it, reads the glacier plaque. The species became extinct through the avarice of and thoughtlessness of man, reads the pigeon plaque. These monuments are significant because they point to an ongoing shift in the dominant culture toward finding nature, especially vanishing nature, grievable. And this, of course, echoes earlier forms of imperialist nostalgia. Yet their suggestion that a universal and undifferentiated humanity is responsible for this loss is a product of that same structural blindness that Heather Ann Swanson attributes to white middle-class America, a refusal to notice that the forces that produce these extinctions, these floods, were exerted by some humans and not others. As Zoe Todd writes, quote, not all humans are equally implicated in the forces that created the disasters driving contemporary human environmental crises. And I argue that not all humans are equally invited into the conceptual spaces where these disasters are theorized or responses to disaster formulated.
In starting our seminar here and now, we are making two implicit propositions. The first is that what has been called the Anthropocene is not the inevitable product of humanity writ large, but rather the consequence of Euro-American colonialism and the capitalist economic systems it built. Field Station 2, Anthropocene Drift, makes visible not just the Anthropocene, but the colonial Anthropocene, which is to say, it reveals how ongoing processes of colonization are transforming the Earth. The colonial Anthropocene is everywhere, of course, but it is palpable in places like Black Hawk Park, Indian Lake, and the former site of the Badger Army Ammunition Plant, all of which we'll visit in the coming days. But what use are these terms? Why quibble over the distinctions between the Anthropocene and the colonial Anthropocene, let alone the differences between other terms such as Capitalocene, Plantationocene, or Thulocene? The Anthropocene is inherently colonial and anti-Black. It began with widespread colonialism and slavery, as Simon Lewis and Mark Maslin argue in placing the Anthropocene's golden spike with the Orbis event of 1619, the first human-made shift in atmospheric carbon dioxide levels precipitated by genocidal conquest. To call it the colonial Anthropocene or a billion Black Anthropocenes is therefore redundant, yet it seems necessary. Heather Davis and Zoe Todd's question, what can we do with the Anthropocene as a conceptual apparatus that may serve to undermine the condition it names? It has been taken up in different and generative ways by many writers, Anna Spice, Kyle Powis White, Macarena Gomez Vares, Catherine Yusoff, Anna Tsing, Donna Haraway, and many others.
Our second proposition is that the Anthropocene is an uneven spatial phenomenon. Debates about the start of the Anthropocene are usually framed in temporal rather than spatial terms. When did it begin, we ask, not where did it start? Dates are singular rather than plural. The Anthropocene started in either 1492, 1610, 1619, 1950. It didn't start in all these plus a million other times and places. We contend that the Anthropocene is both a world geohistorical event and a highly variegated and textured condition that is experienced unevenly and very specifically across space, species, gender, race, class. Field Station 2, Anthropocene Drift, asks not when did the colonial Anthropocene begin, but instead where is it most visible? And where, how, and by whom is it felt most intensely? Part of our interest in the Driftless area is pragmatic insofar as it ties the Anthropocene to colonialism in place. It's ironic to think about the Anthropocene in terms of the temporal golden spikes. Spikes are, after all, driven into space, not time. They are staples connecting one thing with another, an attempt to bridge a gap. According to Manu Kuruka, the other famous golden spike, the one that completed the first transcontinental railroad, quote, did not suture the Union after the Civil War. It symbolically finalized the industrial infrastructure of a continental empire where none had existed before. But if you wanted to place a spatial temporal golden spike to mark the start of the Anthropocene in the upper Midwest, or from 1787 to 1803, the old Northwest Territory, the confluence of the Bad Axe and Mississippi Rivers, or Black Hawk Park, would be an ideal location. Yet framing the quotidian Anthropocene as starting here risks reducing this place to the massacre and reinforcing what Mark Rifkin calls settler time, a temporality that consigns Native peoples to the past while selectively admitting them to a present defined entirely in settler terms. Only within settler time could the Black Hawk conflict be the last Indian war east of the Mississippi. This designation is another instance of the phenomenon of lasting, which historian Gene O'Brien identifies as, quote, a rhetorical strategy that asserts as a fact the claim that Indians can never be modern. The Black Hawk War was obviously not the last Indian war, nor was it the last conflict over settlement or sovereignty in the Midwest or anywhere else. It wasn't even the last Black Hawk War. Ironically, the longest and most destructive conflict between so-called pioneer immigrants and Native Americans in Utah history, which occurred 33 years after the conflict in Illinois, is also commonly referred to as the Black Hawk War. Similarly, calling the Anthropocene the new geologic time that we are all in only makes sense in the framework of settler time. It enshrines linear Western temporality into a teleological vision of planetary history, capped off by a potentially apocalyptic rupture engendered by humanity writ large. As Kyle Powis White argues, this view overlooks that indigenous peoples in North America, quote, are already living in what our ancestors would have understood as dystopian or post-apocalyptic times. Climate injustice for indigenous peoples, he suggests, is less about the specter of a new future and more like the experience of colonial deja vu. For this reason, we will largely not be talking about the Anthropocene this week. Instead, we will be learning about what Gerald Bisner calls survivance, a combination of survival and endurance, in the face of extended violent eco-social trauma. What we seek to listen and learn from indigenous people, we do not intend to hold up indigenous resilience or resurgence as a model for settler society, such that the refusal to be eliminated becomes yet another resource for Euro-Americans to plunder. While we hope for a meaningful exchange across difference, we do not pretend that doing so signals some kind of reconciliation or forges a common understanding. Rather, we seek to highlight both what is relational and what is incommensurable about living an inescapably earthbound life in this place, whether indigenous, settler, arrivant, or all three.
In the Vermilion River watershed near the border of Illinois and Indiana, there has been something of a successful campaign against the unregulated impacts of wasteland coal-burning power plants, which of course are always located alongside rivers. A coalition of urban and rural organizations, including the Prairie Rivers Network, Faith in Place, Eco Justice Collaborative, and Earth Justice, mobilized a large, politically diverse population to pressure the state of Illinois to force power companies to deal with the problems posed by mountains of coal ash. At one Illinois EPA hearing I was at just this past March, residents packed a gym at Danville Community College, arguing that the river needed to residents represent a largely white, rural, working class population that voted for Trump in 2016 and have no illusions that they are representing anything other than their intentions in maintaining their property claims and protecting the health of their families and friends. But I could also choose to hear at least some recognition of what one of our participants, Alyosha Goldstein, along with J.D. Byrd and other scholars, have called grounded relationalities, which they describe as, this is a quote from a recent article by them, if the grounded relationalities of indigenous philosophies might tell us anything, then they remind us that knowledge must always remain grounded as the land calls to us and for us to find our place within the ongoing acts of interconnectivity that surround us. Unquote. How might their experience as settlers in the colonial Anthropocene, and here I'm speaking about the residents who attended this hearing, be mobilized towards living within it differently? Alyosha and his co-authors argue for a consideration of how land, quote, understood not as property or territory, but as a source of relation with an agency of its own, might make other possibilities available, possibilities that recognize the racialized and embodied histories that we have inherited and continue to create.
So you will have noticed that we are opening the seminar without the visible or audible participation of Native people in this spiritually, historically, and ecologically charged place. Early in our planning, we spent several weeks asking individuals that we knew or who worked with before in the Sauk, Meskwaki, Ho-Chunk, and Kickapoo tribes to meet us here to address this story. Tomorrow morning, we'll tour the Kickapoo Valley Reserve with Bill Quackenbush, the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for the Ho-Chunk Nation. When we asked Bill about joining us here this afternoon, he politely declined, saying that he and his people are not particularly interested in revisiting the Bad Axe Massacre, especially not for an audience. Our internal perspectives, stories, and histories of this and many other traumatic events are only intended to stay within our tribal communities, he said. Bill helped us understand that an invitation to perform or narrate at this site of trauma is inappropriate. It is only within settler time that this history needs to be specifically addressed as such, since it is being actively lived and survived and worked through by indigenous communities every day. If the colonial Anthropocene is to be survivable, indigenous and settler-descended people will have different roles. As Dakota medicine gardener Francis Bellioun explained in Corinne Teed's booklet for the seminar, some of you have picked it up already, quote, we, Dakota people, are indigenizing. We're not decolonizing. Your work is decolonizing. This field station, Anthropocene Drift, is a humble start to that work.
So the Anthropocene Drift program is designed to open up some of these questions, to use the motif of the drift to refer to the geology we were in, the format of our traveling conversation, and maybe the desire to drift a bit from the confines of the dominant discourse of the Anthropocene, without adding to the list of alternative names, some of which we drifted at a minute ago. There are a few key components this project, the Anthropocene Drift, is a larger kind of container. One is what we are calling the marine terminal, which includes the materials that are in this welcoming tent there. And it's designed to be a welcoming device and sort of an exhibition that will travel with us that includes the materials in there. And of course, the work of artist Dylan Miner, or rather excerpt from a project by Dylan Miner called This Land Is Always. These four banners are part of them, and the larger horizontal banners on the tent are also part of that project of his. The second component are the field guides to the Anthropocene Drift, a collection of five booklets that invite readers, especially those of us who are settlers, arrivants, or immigrants to these lands, to consider ways of being responsible and inviting guests. The volumes were created by myself, one book, Sarah, Nick and Rizalinda Fochilla, Corinne Teed with Francis Bedouin and Rhonda Funmaker, and Heather Parrish and Sam Munoz. The third component, over the levee, under the plow, the mobile seminar for which this is our opening event. Over the next 4 days, we have a series of talks, walks, and other activities that will take us through Wisconsin and eventually to the Quad Cities of Iowa and Illinois on the Mississippi River. There's a program that includes a lot more details about what will happen over the next 4 days, but I'll explain just a little bit about what will happen in some of those places. Tomorrow will be based at the Kickapoo Valley Reserve, a unique conservation and recreation area jointly managed by the state of Wisconsin and the Ho-Chunk Nation. created on land cleared of settler farms for a never-built flood control dam. It is therefore a site where diverse attachments to the landscape are palpable, where differences between native and non-native practices of conservation are worked through, and where the term restoration takes on multivalent meanings. On Friday, the seminar heads outdoors to explore the landscape on foot and to consider the ways of learning and knowing that such embodied inquiry allows. We gather at the site of former Badger Army Ammunition Plant to learn how the Ho-Chunk are restoring a heavily contaminated 20th century military site before we head to the Ice Age Trail at nearby Devil's Lake for exercises in observing, moving, and thinking from the Ice Age to the Anthropocene. On Saturday, we travel from Dane County, Wisconsin to Moline, Illinois to examine the interplay of displacement, integration, and hydrological engineering in producing the landscapes of extractive agriculture celebrated in the racialized mythology of the American heartland. On Sunday, our seminar concludes at Black Hawk State Historic Site in present-day Rock Island to consider sovereign lands, languages, foods, and futures. Those of you who are still with us at that time will see a small boulder there inscribed with a simple message from the Sac and Fox Nation in memoriam of the fraudulent Treaty of 1804. In the early 1800s, this place was known as Sakina, and it was home to as many as 6,000 indigenous people. This boulder is a physical manifestation of the political practice described by Estes, which, invoking Dr. Simpson, is structured by a refusal to accept the impossible condition of banishment, and disappearance from one's homeland, and outright dispossession. Near this erratic from the colonial Anthropocene, we will conclude with a community feast and celebration. Which I don't have my notes for, so hopefully I will not leave anything out. We just want to thank both the people and organizations and institutions that helped make this possible. In particular, the Hakave, which is the organizing institution for this larger project, many of which of you are taking part in over the course of a couple of months. The Goethe Institute also is being a supporter of our specific initiative, as well as a few others within this larger project. My home institution at the University of Illinois has also supported a lot of what we're going to be doing over the next 4 days. And then also, and more importantly, the people who are joining us on this. All of you for being here, of course, but also our primary interlocutors. Trying to think of the order in which we're doing this. Sure. Yeah, so maybe if those of you who are going to be our interlocutors and sort of conversants over the course of the next 4 days, if you can stand up.
Not everyone has arrived yet, but.
You're all going to be our interlocutors, but we
they will help us think through some of these things. So, it's Dr. Alyosha Goldstein.
Wait, what?
What's her name? Dr. Rose Milton.
Alyosha, she sounds like it's
closer. Dr. Tom Carroll. Yeah. Also, Rosalinda Bortilla, who is helping us with quite a few things and is one of the co-producers of one of the books. I also want to acknowledge two graduate students from the University of Illinois, Meredith Dallas and Katie Netty, who are helping sort of move a lot of us around and deal with a lot of other logistics. Some folks who are not here, one of my colleagues from the University of Illinois, Dr. Toby Beauchamp, who will be joining us tomorrow. And Stephanie Springway from Toronto will also be joining us tomorrow.
For the final feast, and with the meals for some of the speakers, we are working with really food artists, Invictus Voices, Rhonda Funmaker and Jody Smith, who are probably cooking right now, but we want to acknowledge the importance of their contribution, which is both food and the interview in Corinne's book.
And they're both Ho-Chunk.
Yeah.
And for Sunday, like the Meskwaki Tri Nations Youth Council, it's a big day.
There there's a big day with many, many people. So we have Christine Novus from Seeding Sovereignty, three people, Regina Thosi and two other people, I don't yet know their names, from the Native American Coalition of the Quad City. A group of youth are coming from the Shy Nations Youth Council in Chicago, and then folks from the Meskwaki Language Preservation, Meskwaki Food Sovereignty, and Meskwaki Historic Preservation Offices.
And Jackie Rand, and Dr. Jackie Rand is from the University of Iowa.
So Sunday is a very large group of people, so if you weren't planning on sticking around, you should. Want to talk about the transit?
Sure. What time is it?
It is 5:30.
So yeah, the plan now is to, for those of you who want to join us, hop in the vans, and basically we're sort of making the argument that the colonial Anthropocene begins here, and we want to take you on a little 10-mile stretch of the Great River Road Scenic Byway, and show you a handful of sites which in many ways sort of encapsulate everything that we have been talking about now and everything that we will see over the next few days. This particular, obviously, Black Hawk Park is a fraught, layered, complex site, and the sort of constellation of sites along just this little stretch of river is almost unbelievably sort of complex and fraught and contradictory, and it just reveals for me, it kind of beckons a visit from us. So the plan is to hop in the vans and go visit a few of these sites. We'll be visiting two locations where there are sets of historical markers, and there we're thinking that we'll just stay in the vans to make things go a little bit more quickly. The first of which is a site just across the lagoon there, where there are historical markers commemorating the Bad Axe Massacre. And so we will start there, then we'll go upriver, and we will visit another set of historical markers that speak to the Lock and Dam number 8, operated by the Army Corps of Engineers, which some of you may have passed or paddled past on your way here, portaged around. And that is right, the Lock and Dam there is right next to the Dairyland Power Cooperative and also the former La Crosse boiling water nuclear reactor, which is a really interesting sort of example of rural small-scale nuclear power. A plant that was in operation for about 20 years, closed in the mid-80s, but as you'll see, you can't miss the Dairyland Power Cooperative, which is a massive coal-fired power plant. Right before we get to that, be looking out and you'll notice a area that is where there are big fences, high security, and where there's not much except this casket in the middle. And that casket is where all the spent nuclear fuel rods from this boiling water reactor are being stored. It was intended to be temporary storage, but is the case at all these spots. It has become at least semi-permanent. The nuclear waste is still there, right in the floodplain, right next to the power plant. So we had hoped to get out at the Lock and Dam, but I think because of time, we'll see how long it takes to get there, because the Lock and Dam is really interesting, and from the Lock and Dam, you have an amazing view of the power plant. They're right next to one another. But just a little bit beyond that, then, is a place that is much easier to miss. It's a place that I had never been to until earlier this summer, and I grew up in this area. It's a little cemetery called Riverside Cemetery, and it is right on the bank of the river, and it's a settler cemetery. But it's one that's built on top of a series of burial mounds, 1,000, 2,000-year-old indigenous burial mounds, where you have headstones literally sort of coming out of on top of these mounds. And so it is much like this place, I think, and is where we will go and conclude the opening event tonight. And then we'll come back here, or I'll come back here with a few books and take this Meaning we're gonna leave now and not worry about this stuff. If you're, yeah, if you're in, we have, yeah.